Deconstruct 2015 will happen in the Brighton Dome on September 11th. My name's Jeremy, and I'm going to be there. You should be there too. You can get your ticket at deconstruct.org. Hello, Ingrid.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
Whereabouts on the planet are you?
I live in New York. Mm-hmm. I like to borrow a joke from the actor and writer Spalding Gray and tell people that I live on a small island off the coast of America, which is why I think a lot of people choose to live in New York, so they can be near America, but maybe not have all of the immediate consequences of America thrown at them.
So New York is sort of its own special zone.
It's not really a semi-autonomous region, but it likes to believe it is.
Now, were I to visit New York, and were I to wish to get a field guide to New York, I understand that you might be able to help me out there.
Yeah, it's a very particular kind of field guide. I created a field guide to New York City internet infrastructure, which basically is to say a guide to being able to see all of the kind of remnants and signifiers of networks and network connectivity that you might find on the street.
Well, this is exactly the kind of field guide that I would be interested in. I kind of have this thing for the infrastructure level stuff. I like seeing where the underwater cables come ashore and where the servers live. So would you be able to show me where there's server hotels in New York?
Yeah, the guide itself features kind of the three biggest Manhattan carrier hotels. They're all kind of vaguely like historical or like prominent, partly just because they're so old and they have, I don't know, one of the things I love about at least some of in like older cities, their internet infrastructure is usually just an inheritance of whatever telecommunications infrastructure was there before. So one of the largest carrier hotels in New York City is the old Western Union Telegraph headquarters, and another used to be the AT&T Long Lines building. So they sort of just repurposed them because they already had all of the ducts that they needed. And they're these sort of fabulous deco buildings that speak to kind of a lost idealism for what connectivity might bring us.
And so these buildings, they're in the middle of New York City. That sounds like prime real estate to me. And they're being used by machines rather than humans. I mean, are we planning our cities around the needs of the algorithm these days?
Both of those carrier hotels as examples, they do have some offices. Generally, there's a floor or a couple of floors that are dedicated around servers. A lot of the buildings that are purely for machines, you're still going to be seeing put out a little more remotely. There's some interesting work. Basically, there's some interesting work that's already been done by others around the New Jersey data center universe, which is where actually a lot of like finance trading now happens because it's in these sort of repurposed industrial environments that were never really designed for humans and have buildings that no humans will really ever go into. It's interesting too. I was just in Atlanta and kind of took a detour to go see a Google data center. It's kind of just outside of the city, and it's in this sort of semi-industrial area, but you have a lot of like logistics centers, which is to say, you know, shipping and distribution things. So in a weird way, the spaces where you're going to have buildings designed for machines are also going to be buildings designed kind of for humans, but more for goods and services that humans have to kind of package and transfer.
You know, I remember reading the book Tubes by Andrew Blum, which is, you know, the maps of the internet and where the internet lives. And I remember him remarking that Google are remarkably secretive about what goes on inside their buildings, given that, you know, they want us to share all our data with them, but they're less open about sharing what's going on inside. Did you manage to get inside that building in Atlanta?
Oh, that we were turned around the moment we got to the gate. We got basically it was the triumph of being able to find the Google data center was the victory that we were able to take with us. Although I've got to say it was kind of brilliant. The sign outside the data center was on, you know, a little like kind of median with these pink flowers that were kind of overgrown, which meant that the sign, which, you know, has the Google logo on it, was halfway hidden. And it was, you know, the tops of the O's were kind of peeking out as though Google was saying, like, if I just stay very still, they won't see me here. No data centers in this spot. No, sir. There's something very funny about how a lot of these spaces try to not call attention to themselves, and in so doing, make themselves far more obvious.
Right. I mean, you've got an example from the NSA, right? About taking photographs of the NSA building and not taking, that's just kind of absurd in a way.
Yeah. They have a sign that has a picture of the kind of picture you shouldn't take on the NSA grounds. Like they've managed to corner that, not only kind of like what you're allowed to do or not do, but they also like can visualize this impossible image for you.
It starts to get completely absurd when they're trying to own the photons. So what led you to create the Field Guide of New York, or generally does this interest in you know, the infrastructure level stuff, the physicality of the internet?
You know, a lot of it actually kind of, it's useful you brought up the NSA thing, because some of this started with watching a lot of the Snowden stories start coming out 2 years ago and seeing a lot of stock imagery of, like, people at laptops or some, like, green and black and numbers and lots of things that just did not look like it involved humans or there weren't, and it didn't look like any of the pieces of the internet, really. I was like, I'm not sure what this is, but I definitely don't think it's this. And I wanted to find out, basically. And so that started with some of the like architecture around the NSA and like office parks near the NSA. And the second you start going into that like suburban Maryland, Northern Virginia region of the United States, you end up running into data centers because there's kind of like a huge piece of internet backbone right around Northern Virginia for, you know, obvious historical reasons. And that sort of got me down this rabbit hole of trying to find kind of the spaces of the internet that are usually placed very, very far away from humans. And what led me to the Field Guide was really having spent all this time looking at these things that were far away from humans and realizing I was still sort of treating the internet as something that happened somewhere else, as opposed to something that was all around me all the time. Like, how could it not be? So I started trying to piece together not just the local landmarks, like the carrier hotels, but also some of the smaller indicators, like utility locating markings that tell you what's buried underneath the ground. It's usually spray painted on the street. I'm not sure how it works in other places, but in the States, it's generally like if someone's going to be doing street excavation, utility companies have to mark off whether they have any conduits on the street. They're all color-coded, and they're usually labeled by what they are, so you can pretty easily figure out where a fiber optic cable is walking down a street in Manhattan.
Right, so these are like the signifiers of the stuff that's for most people, simply invisible in their lives. The kind of stuff that most people would think of as being the cloud, which doesn't strike me as being a very accurate term to describe something so physical.
The cloud is the worst. The day that a bunch of, you know, marketing consultants got together and said, all right, what are we going to call this thing? And they came up with the cloud was a rueful day for the world. Yeah, a lot of these things that can easily on kind of a, I don't know, Zoom level, 22 level, tell you where infrastructure is around you. They are things that I wouldn't say they're invisible so much as they're designed to be kind of forgotten about. Mm-hmm. Or they're maybe illegible, right? Like those spray painted markings definitely mean something to somebody who has to go, you know, tear up a street or go into a manhole. They definitely mean something to the person who put them on the ground for, you know, whatever agency they're working for. But it's also, you know, in a city, especially in a city like New York, walking around and staring at the ground isn't highly recommended. And yeah, it's stuff that doesn't appear to have any immediate bearing, so it quickly fades into the background.
Well, I guess it's almost like war chalking or something, right? You need to know the lingo in order to interpret the signals.
Hobo codes.
Right. Not going to ask you to describe what you do. Listen, you're not a cartographer and you're not a comedian, but you make maps and you tell jokes. Would that be right?
That's usually what I tell people. It's to the point, you know.
So why those two particular tools, maps and jokes?
Maps and jokes. Well, I think maps are kind of, I think, how I fell into a lot of this world of things. And I suppose maps because are useful. Well, they're both maps and jokes are useful as ways of kind of being able to unpack and try and articulate systems, particularly systems of power, as they're both kind of very useful instruments of power. And but they're also something that maybe that, well, maps have slightly more technical things, but, you know, anybody kind of knows a map when they see it or knows a joke when they see one and can kind of comprehend them. So I think of them as kind of they're maybe more accessible entry points to engaging with or talking about or trying to understand power dynamics or systems.
Right. So it's the fact that they're relatable that sort of makes them suitable for kicking off a discussion rather than something that requires a insider knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, I always forget. I always assume that like everyone has knowledge that I have once I learn it. You know, like if I know this fact, it must have been common knowledge. And so I take it for granted sometimes that what I have could be considered insider expertise. So part of it is wanting to try and deflate that assumption or trying to make things relatable.
When you come over for Deconstruct, will this be your first visit to Brighton?
It will be my first visit to Brighton.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. We'll have to make sure that you have a good time and explore all that Brighton has to offer. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're planning to talk about at Deconstruct?
Yeah, when Andy first contacted me about this and told me sort of the theme of the event, you know, when you spend a lot of your time on infrastructural things, you tend to get really tied down to the here and now, right? Especially when you're making maps too. So the future, I was like, I'm not sure. But I had written an essay a few months ago about a group of activists in the early 1990s who had made an attempt to destroy some government-owned network infrastructure as a gesture against the coming space wars, basically. And they had that, and that particular infrastructure was early GPS. Which is itself kind of a fascinating little story, but they had explicitly in their action made references to the character of Sarah Connor from the Terminator series. I was able to track down one of the guys from that action, and we had this whole conversation about what the Terminator meant to him and to his comrades at that time that made me think a lot about how time travel narratives often... What they can tell us or how they shape the way that we think about designing futures or the way that we even think about the personify or anthropomorphize the future itself, because the future is something we're never coming towards in time travel. The future is always coming at us, and it usually has its own ideas about what we should be doing.
Right. Well, because most time travel narratives fall into one of two camps, right? There's the sort of the Greek tragedy where the future is fixed and there's nothing you can do to change it. And in fact, trying to change it is going to cause it to come about. And then there's the other narrative, which often involves parallel universes, where the future is whatever you make it. And every small effect you take in the present or the past is going to change the future. So was the attitude you were seeing, you know, those particular protesters, more that second version where if we take action now, we are going to have much bigger effects on the future?
I would say it was much more of the second kind of multiverse attitude, which is probably reflected by the fact they were much more into the second Terminator film than the first one, because the entire first Terminator film is the time travel paradox. Like nothing in that movie, everything that happens in that movie means that everything in that movie happens.
Right. Yeah. And they kind of changed the rules for the second film and said, actually, we're dealing with this kind of time travel, not that kind of time travel.
Yeah. And they keep, I mean, it's, I imagine it's not so much an intentional, like, internal struggle over the meaning of time travel so much as somebody realized that it was a quite lucrative franchise. But yeah, they keep playing fast and loose with what kind of time travel they're talking about. And I went and saw the most recent one, which you don't have to. But I was quite amused that, spoiler alert, there is kind of a multiverse jumping villain character, because it's a totally forked timeline version of the Terminator series. But this multiverse character is played by Matt Smith, and I was like, somebody in casting is very clever.
Yeah, when you're talking about, you know, internal consistency, at least the Terminator films are a bit more internally consistent than Doctor Who, which is just all bets are off, basically. Right?
Well, maybe we should be worried that they brought Matt Smith in.
Yeah, it's like, that's it. Logic's gone out the window. So does that mean you've been deep diving into time travel fiction and internal logic within time travel narratives?
Yeah, I mean, another thing I guess that had been on my mind, as I imagine it's been on a lot of fellow nerds' minds, was The Peripheral, which I was looking, I just thought was one of the most refreshing kind of forays back into time. I hadn't really looked at time travel for a really long time, and then came about, and I was like, oh, right.
So let's just sound the spoiler klaxon right here, so that we're free to talk about anything in that book. So anybody who hasn't read The Peripheral, stop listening now. I thought it was an amazing book.
Yeah.
Particularly the way it treats the future, or sort of it treats the past, almost in a colonial kind of way. There's this gentrification or exploitation of the past, which is kind of would have been in previous time travel narratives, but not to the same level that it's brought to the surface in that book.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember who I was reading. I mean, it might have been Madeline Ashby who mentioned something about that, about the way in which, like, most time travel about people from the future coming to the past, it's usually conquerors who like to come to the past. They usually can get a lot more out of it.
I mean, we could just geek out about various time travel pieces. I'm quite happy to. For me, it is right up there as one of the most interesting takes. Particularly, well, technically, there isn't time travel in the sense of things physically moving in time, because that always brings up its own issues of, you know, why do things move in time but not in space, or why do you materialize in one place not in another. The fact that it's purely information that's traveling between future and past, and how these days that's enough. You don't necessarily need to move atoms from place to place or time to time, that if you can move information, you are effectively ordering the world as you see fit.
Yeah, and there's something I've been really fascinated by, and I suppose it goes far before kind of the world of Web 2.0 or anything like that, but I kind of think of it initially starting in that world of like this fascination with having real-time data, real-time information. You see that a lot in like high-frequency trading. You see that a lot with like counterterrorism operations, this idea that we can just know all of the things right now, right? And they will not, and act within, you know, kind of microseconds of that information, then nothing terrible will ever happen and we will always win. And there is a weird kind of acceleration that goes into like achieve the state of real time. You're kind of trying to actually step slightly like ahead of time. You know, that's where you see a lot of like the predictive stuff that comes into a real-time analysis.
Right, it's the total information awareness, you know, step one, total information awareness, step two, step three, you know, godhood, we are controlling the world. Yeah, I guess it's like the idea of Laplace's demon all over again, that if you know the precise position of every particle in the universe, then you are essentially controlling the universe.
Yeah, there's a way, it's like real time almost sounds kind of more like a state that you like achieve via like conscientious meditation.
Right, like nirvana, real time.
Yeah, time is much realer now, or all fake,
Time is realer than it ever has been before. Will we be hearing a lot about various time travel narratives in your talk then?
Works of fiction. I do have a tendency towards probably the lower brow strains of it, partly just because, you know, I like a good popcorn flick, but looking at some of those, actually one of the more guilty pleasure ones I've gotten really into is this Canadian science fiction show called Continuum.
Yeah, I've been watching that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not actually good, but I was a friend of mine who introduced it to me was like, now this may sound kind of, you know, was trying to like caution me, like this is going to sound kind of inconceivable, but in the future, the most important city in the world is Vancouver, Canada. Yeah, that is pretty surprising.
It's a good premise to start from.
No, it is. I do think it's kind of a, it is definitely a compelling show, and it is like a good starting point, especially just kind of watching the protagonist kind of realizing the like implications of the world she's trying to save.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What if we're the bad guys? Yeah. Like, again, I don't know whether this is deliberate writing on behalf of the writers or whether it's just, you know, narrative for the sake of it. But I haven't got to season three of Continuum, but it seems to be that it hasn't quite decided which sort of time travel it is yet, whether it's the, you know, multiverse forking or whether it's Greek tragedy, everything is predetermined.
Yeah, it seems as though they keep changing their minds about which one they want it to be. I feel like, though, in general, what that usually means is eventually, like, things eventually just collapse into multiverse. If you're going to do anything that's a series, it's going to collapse in a multiverse because you just can't, you can't sustain a paradox.
You have to have a reset every now and then, like the Marvel Universe, I guess.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, in terms of internal consistency, the one that springs to mind would be Primer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that feels like it's the most well thought through, and it's one where the more you poke at it to test it and see whether it's actually being internally consistent, it, instead of collapsing like so many do, it actually comes out stronger. It's like, oh wow, it really is, you know, very solid. So time travel is going to be in your talk. That sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. It sounds like it could fit very well with a lot of the other talks that are coming up for Deconstruct. I mean, it looks like a lot of the other speakers are very much looking to the works of fiction, speculative fiction, to examine today's world and the future, designing the future and all that. But I think what's interesting is that most others are coming at it from the point of view of technologies rather than this more ideas. I mean, time travel is more, I think, more of a concept than a technology. And is that generally where your focus is? I mean, do you like to focus on technology, or do you like to focus on technology's effects?
Having one without the others is a little bit one-sided. I think one of the things that I think time travel is kind of an idea, like, introduces a way to think about things we expect maybe from technologies or expect from, like, our futures. And I suppose that I tend to lean more towards the ideas and the unpacking and mapping and articulating of things, partly because there are just so many things. I don't need to make more things. We have such an infinite amount of them, and half of them we don't even understand. So far be it from me to add more things to the pile.
This brings up another question. Whenever we're talking about the future, technology, time travel, any of these ideas, there's a fairly fundamental question. It's very hard to boil down into a black and white answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
This makes me think about the ending of The Peripheral, actually.
Right.
Spoilers again, sorry. But I remember seeing Gibson do a Q&A at NYPL a few months ago. Basically, just the question of whether people thought the ending of The Peripheral was hopeful or not. And how your take on it really had so much to do with kind of how far you would forecast things, maybe. Because it's not a clean ending, and it's, you know, this isn't a clean answer to your question. But I guess I would say my optimism lies maybe more in a certain amount of faith in humans than and in the idea that maybe the universe is far bigger and far more complicated than humans like to believe it is. So to a certain extent, to believe that I know how anything is going to work out is slightly ridiculous, which is kind of a vaguely hopeful place to start from, because it allows you a certain degree of relief from feeling as though you have to fix everything or you have to save everything, because you can try, but know that the world sometimes has different plans than the ones you think that it should have.
Now, I wonder, if you were to move out of New York and move to California, and I asked you that question in a year or two, whether you would have been borged into the complete opposite way, which is like, yeah, you know, the future is something we make, and technology, we control the world, and it's ours to build, and we are as gods. Because it strikes me that seems to be the dominant narrative coming out of Silicon Valley.
I would be curious to check in with Silicon Valley in a year as the water wars intensify. And I mean, I grew up in Silicon Valley. And it's a very, I would say that a lot of the characterizations that exist about it are accurate, but also, like, I mean, they speak to something much deeper than just, like, technologists. They speak to kind of a longstanding sort of, like, frontiersman ethos that permeates a lot of the American West. They speak to a kind of constant rewriting of its own history. And I don't know. I mean, I also, like, Silicon Valley has changed so much since I left for school when I was a teenager. It's hard to, like, really, like, it was always, you know, it's always been kind of like this, like, nexus of privilege and power, but it's hard to convey just how much, like, that money, like, exploded after 2008, I guess. It's kind of like when I used to tell people I was from Silicon Valley and they'd say, where's that? and now when I say that, they would say, they treat it as though I haven't described a place, I've described a political condition, like, yeah. I come from Marxism, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, like you say, it is not an embodiment, I guess a geographical embodiment of a certain spirit that has positive and negative, like, say, that idea of the frontier, that history of the frontier, which is also, you know, going back to time travel in speculative fiction, is almost treats the future in the same way as something to explore, and that's why we have time travel. Well, I guess future facing time travel is to get out there and get into the future and make it. I'm wondering what you're going to make of Brighton when you come over here. It's going to be quite different from New York and quite different from Silicon Valley. It's sort of its own thing.
Yeah, my good friend George Voss, who I think is based in Brighton, has...
Yeah, George, you spoke at last year's Deconstruct, yeah, and it was fantastic.
She's promised to show me the best that Brighton has to offer, and apparently there's lots of cool infrastructure, so...
Oh, yeah, well, she will be the perfect tour guide. That's fantastic. Well, I'm really looking forward to having you here in Brighton, and really looking forward to hearing your talk. And, Ingrid, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you.